Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a run at one of the most publicly complex figures of modern Hollywood.
Definitely. This is an individual whose life and career have been consistently scrutinized across multiple very different spheres.
Right. From indie films to billion-dollar franchises and, you know, simultaneously across two international courtrooms.
We are, of course, talking about Amber Laura Heard, born April 22, 1986, in Austin, Texas.
And the thing is, it's not just a large amount of material we're working with here.
It's a conflicting one. I mean, we're dealing with sources that cover everything from high-impact humanitarian work to the microscopic details of, well, corporate litigation and personal lawsuits.
Absolutely. So our mission here isn't just to summarize, but to really extract the most important nuggets from this mountain of information. We're conducting a thorough deep dive into the source material.
The full career arc, her surprisingly extensive activism, that complex personal history.
And of course, the high-profile legal battles that have completely reshaped her public image over the last decade.
And we should acknowledge right up front that this material is often, you know, politically or personally charged.
Very much so.
Therefore, our primary goal for you, the listener, is structural understanding. We're here to provide a clear, structured view of the facts as they're presented in these sources.
Highlighting multiple perspectives, all the nuanced details, but without taking sides.
Exactly. We want you to walk away well-informed about the timeline, the professional milestones, and all the legal intricacies.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we get into the bright lights of Hollywood and the courtrooms, let's establish some foundational context, you know, the beginnings that set the stage for her life.
What's fascinating here is the early indication of someone who actively chose to challenge the expectations of her immediate environment.
How so?
Well, Heard was the middle child of three daughters, born to Patricia Page, an internet researcher, and David Clinton Heard, who owned a construction company.
And her upbringing sounds quintessentially Texan.
Oh, completely. The sources detail it. And she spent her time outside Austin, riding horses, hunting, and fishing with her father.
So a deeply conservative, traditional backdrop. How did she move away from that?
That traditional structure just didn't hold. I mean, she was raised Catholic, but by the age of 16, after a friend tragically died in a car crash, she began identifying as an atheist.
Wow, at 16, that's a profound shift.
It is. And this realization, coupled with feeling increasingly uncomfortable in what she herself described as that conservative, God-fearing Texas environment, led to a really swift and definitive choice.
Which was?
She dropped out of Catholic high school at 17 to immediately move to Los Angeles and pursue acting. She only later earned her diploma through a home study course.
That's a bold early move, choosing a highly volatile career path and a completely different world at such a young age.
It really is. That early shift away from established religious and geographic roots seems to sort of foreshadow her later pattern of challenging the status quo, even if it brings conflict.
Okay, so let's move into her professional life. We see the expected trajectory of a young actor trying to find a footing in the early 2000s.
Her career began in 2003. With small appearances, the kind of things you do to build a resume.
And those early steps included music videos, which was, you know, a pretty common path at the time for up-and-coming talent.
Exactly. She was featured in Kenny Chesney's There Goes My Life and Isley's I Wasn't Prepared.
At the same time, she started landing small supporting roles in television.
Yeah, shows like Jack and Bobby, The Mountain, and The O.C. Her film debut came just a year later, in 2004, with a minor role in the highly regarded sports drama Friday Night Lights.
But the breakthrough moment, the first time she really carried a film, was with All the Boys Love Mandy Lane.
Ah, yes. A project that became notorious for its distribution challenges.
It's such a strange story because the film itself was critically well received, but its commercial life was almost non-existent for years.
It really was. It's a slasher film where she played the title character. It premiered to a lot of buzz at the 2006 Toronto International Film Festival, but then nothing.
Nothing.
Well, due to distribution rights issues and just, you know, legal limbo, it wasn't released in Europe until 2008 and shockingly in the U.S. until 2013.
A seven-year delay.
A massive seven-year delay.
7 years is an eternity in Hollywood, especially for a young actor trying to capitalize on momentum. When it did finally reach U.S. audiences, what did critics say about her actual performance?
The reviews really confirmed that the delay was a loss for her career trajectory at that time. Critics recognized her potential. The Los Angeles Times called it her most definitive to date, suggesting it was the best showcase of her talents up to that point.
And the Washington Post had good things to say, too, right?
They did. They noted that the film was psychologically interesting. So, despite the whole commercial fiasco surrounding the release, it was a really solid foundation for her dramatic reputation.
The momentum did seem to pick up around 2008, where she started gaining genuine mainstream visibility.
That's when the transition from indie starlet to, like, a real Hollywood player began. She secured notable supporting roles in two very different high-profile films.
Pineapple Express.
Right. The Seth Rogen stoner comedy, which was a huge box office hit, and then the martial arts drama, Never Back Down.
And she also appeared in the ensemble adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis's novel, The Informers.
Exactly. These roles placed her firmly in the public eye and, importantly, established her capability across different genres.
And some of her performances in the following years really started generating specific critical praise, suggesting she was capable of, you know, stealing scenes.
Yes, look at the Joneses in 2009. She starred opposite David Duchovny and Demi Moore. The industry trade publication Variety noted that Heard more or less steals the show from the veteran Moore.
That's high praise.
Very high praise.
Another interesting project from that period, 2011, was Drive Angry, a commercial failure, but again, her performance was singled out by a major critic.
That's where we see the power of an individual performance, sort of overriding a weak project. The great Roger Ebert, in his review of the supernatural action thriller, wrote that Heard does everything that can possibly be done with her character, a waitress named Piper.
Which suggests a professional capability to elevate even, well, flawed source material.
Precisely.
Now, speaking of flawed projects, we have to mention the notorious television failure, The Playboy Club.
That series was a truly fascinating failure in 2011. And it's a great anecdote about the cultural tension at the time.
It was a crime drama set in 1960s Chicago, and Heard played Bunny Maureen.
And it immediately received poor reviews and terrible ratings. It was canceled after only 3 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But the really interesting detail is the political controversy surrounding it.
What made the controversy so unique?
The show was met with protests from a very unusual combination of groups, feminist organizations, who opposed the depiction and, you know, the perceived exploitation inherent in the premise.
Yeah.
And conservative groups who found the content morally objectionable.
So you're saying it was attacked from both the left and the right.
When you manage to unite both sides of the cultural spectrum against your show, you know you have a massive flop on your hands. It just demonstrated the difficulty of navigating sensitive cultural themes in network television.
Moving into the mid-2010s, she continued to take on diverse roles. Action films like Paranoia, Machete Kills, and 3 Days to Kill.
And she also took supporting roles in bigger studio fare like Magic Mike XXL and a small part in Tom Hooper's The Danish Girl in 2015.
But she kept pursuing roles aimed at dramatic credibility.
Right, like The Adderall Diaries in 2015. And even though IndieWire critiqued the overall casting choices for the film, they specifically noted that Heard displays much potential and has succeeded in a bid to be taken more seriously.
Which suggests a conscious effort to balance that commercial work with projects designed to prove her acting chops.
Exactly.
But the project that became the biggest legal and production headache of her early career was the adaptation of Martin Amis's novel, London Fields.
Oh, this one. This one makes the Mandy Lane delay look minor.
It was a monumental disaster from almost every angle.
From every angle except for the initial filming, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Heard played the lead, Nicholas Six, a clairvoyant femme fatale. It was shot way back in 2013, but the moment it premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2015, it was pulled from release.
Why? What happened?
Immediate and intense litigation between the director and the producers. Just an absolute mess.
And Heard was dragged into that complex legal mess herself, which is an important bit of foreshadowing for her later career.
Precisely. The sources detail she was sued by the production company for $10 million.
$10 million for what?
They claimed she had breached her contractual performance and promotional obligations. But Heard didn't just stand still, she countersued.
On what grounds?
Citing that the producers had violated a nudity rider included in her contract, she argued that certain images were used without her consent.
It sounds like the entire project just imploded in a spectacular fashion that was both professional and deeply personal.
It did. A settlement was finally reached in September 2018, a full 5 years after filming, and the film saw a disastrous limited release. It was called a near-record flop.
And the critics were brutal.
They were, but again, some tried to separate her performance from the surrounding mess. Jane Mulkerins of the Daily Telegraph said Heard provided a decent enough turn that couldn't save the film.
But others felt she was miscast.
Right. Some felt she lacked the required mystery and allure for that specific role.
And she ultimately received a nomination for the Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Actress for the role in 2019.
A perfect example of how complex production and legal issues can completely overshadow artistic merit, a theme that would unfortunately become pretty central to her life.
That turbulent period really sets the stage for her entry into the DC extended universe, which is the phase that brought her immense global recognition and commercial success.
A huge shift. She joined the DCEU in 2017 as Mera, the Princess of an Atlantean Kingdom, debuting in Justice League.
This was a massive step up in terms of franchise filmmaking.
It was a monumental shift in scale. And then the next year brought the tsunami of Aquaman in 2018.
Which grossed over $1 billion worldwide.
A billion. Making it her first major role in a big studio film and transforming her into an undisputed global star.
When she spoke about taking the role, she really emphasized the importance of the character's independence, right?
Absolutely. Oh. She mentioned specifically that she was attracted to the role because Mera was portrayed as a strong, independent, self-possessed superhero in her own right.
And she made a point of noting how Mera rejects the name Aquawoman.
She did. She highlighted that Mera rejects that sort of reductive, traditional comic book name. This detail, you know, it links back to her established advocacy for gender issues and rejecting the status quo.
And the critics responded positively to her handling of the massive genre material.
They did. Reviews generally noted that she embraced the necessary high camp tone. The Independent observed that she camps it up entertainingly, as Mera.
And the Chicago Tribune review noted she lends a blasé air of early 50s B-movie cheese.
Which suggests a knowing, fun performance that fit the bombastic tone of the film perfectly.
She reprised the role, of course, in the director's cut, Zack Snyder's Justice League in 2021, and also appeared in other projects like the miniseries The Stand.
But the planned sequel, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, became perhaps the central flashpoint for the public scrutiny surrounding her legal battles.
This is where public sentiment and franchise decision-making collide dramatically.
The sources detail a timeline starting in late 2020, following her ex-husband's loss in his UK libel case. An intense online petition campaign to remove her from the sequel began.
And that petition gained massive traction.
Surpassing 2 million signatures by the time the U.S. trial started in 2022.
That kind of public pressure is almost unprecedented in terms of a digital effort to remove a core cast member. So how did the narrative surrounding her role reduction play out? We have several conflicting accounts here.
We have three key perspectives from the source material. First, Heard's own claim.
What did she say?
She testified that she fought really hard to stay in the movie, but believed they didn't want to include me in the film, and that she ended up shooting a very pared-down version of her part. She suggested her involvement was significantly minimized.
And what was the studio's explanation for that reduction?
The studio offered a distinct counter-narrative. Walter Hamada, the former DC Studios president, and James Wan, the director, suggested that the decision was purely narrative.
Not related to the legal battles.
That was their claim. Their account stated that the sequel was intentionally going to focus much more heavily on the relationship and buddy cop dynamic between Jason Momoa, Aquaman, and Patrick Wilson's character, Orm.
Making Mera's role naturally less central.
Right. So we have the actress claiming she was cut due to controversy and the studio claiming it was purely a story choice.
That's the core tension.
It is. However, the third perspective comes from external evidence, the critics and her co-stars after the release in 2023.
And what did they observe?
Critics who watched the final product widely observed that her scenes appeared disjointed and heavily edited. One consensus suggested her scenes were sloppy and awkward.
And that she feels as though her scenes were all added in post.
Which gave credence to the idea that her role had been dramatically altered.
And the most compelling support for her claim actually came from within the cast.
That's right. Dolph Lundgren, who plays King Nereus, confirmed these observations. He noted that the original script they had was great, and that both his and Heard's roles were bigger before the studio decided to reshoot a bunch of footage to try to rebuild a slightly different storyline.
That statement from a colleague really supports the idea that the creative vision shifted dramatically, and her involvement was indeed minimized from the initial plans.
It certainly does.
That brings us to her post-trial career, which is defined by a distinct move away from the Hollywood machine and a major geographical shift.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Examining a career that transitioned from billion-dollar blockbusters and massive public scrutiny to independent, artistically driven roles.
So what does that shift look like professionally?
It signals a move toward creative control and smaller projects. Her first film released after the trial was In the Fire in 2023. It's a supernatural thriller where she not only starred, but also served as an executive producer.
And premiering at the Taormina Film Fest, that immediately shows a pivot back to independent cinema.
Exactly. A space where she can exert greater influence over the production.
And she's embracing the stage, which is a significant move for a film actor.
A huge move. She's been cast in Jeremy O'Harris's play Spirit of the People, slated for 2025. Theater work requires absolute presence. And, you know, it offers artistic credibility outside of the metrics of box office or streaming numbers.
It suggests prioritizing the craft of acting over the mechanics of celebrity.
That's a good way to put it. And crucially, she made the physical move as well. Yes. As of June 2023, the sources confirm she resides in Madrid, Spain, and she stated publicly, "I love living here." This major relocation is a definitive physical and professional shift away from the epicenter of the U.S. entertainment and media environment where her legal battles were fought.
It suggests seeking an environment less defined by the Hollywood studio machine and intense American celebrity culture.
That seems to be the case.
You know, before the legal conflicts completely took over her public narrative, Heard had an extensive and high-profile history of activism and ambassadorship. Let's dedicate some time to truly understanding the scope of this work, starting with her international and humanitarian roles.
Her global involvement is genuinely extensive. She served as a human rights ambassador for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights.
And that role is highly selective.
Right. It's centered around supporting campaigns like Stand Up for Human Rights. It demonstrates a real commitment to foundational international law and advocacy.
And she actively used her visibility for speaking engagements directly related to this work.
That's critical. She wasn't just lending her name. She spoke at the UN's 9th Annual Social Good Summit in 2018.
And her speech focused on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It did, emphasizing the centrality of humans, fairness, and justice. She later gave a speech at Hague Talks, an event focused on global change, advocating for the Declaration's 70th anniversary.
We also see her involvement in humanitarian crises closer to home, specifically concerning the U.S.-Mexico border.
Right. With Amnesty International, she traveled to the border and participated in a bilingual campaign designed to raise awareness about U.S. immigration policies and the treatment of those seeking asylum or entry.
Which shows a dedication to issues of movement and displacement, both internationally and domestically.
But perhaps the most detailed and consistent humanitarian work listed in the sources involved her partnership with the Syrian American Medical Society, or SAMHS.
The SAMHS partnership highlights a sustained commitment over multiple years, moving beyond just fundraising.
Absolutely. It began in April 2018, when she joined a multi-specialty medical mission to the Za'atari refugee camp in Jordan, serving as a goodwill ambassador.
And these missions involve hands-on work in extremely challenging environments.
They do. This isn't just a brief visit for a photo op. And she helped address a specific complex medical need there.
What was that?
Following that initial mission, she partnered with SAMHS to help finance treatment for children in the camp suffering from thalassemia, a serious blood disorder.
Which requires consistent, specialized care that is often unavailable in refugee settings.
Exactly. And that wasn't the end of her involvement with SAMHS.
She went on another mission.
In February 2019, she joined a second SAMHS mission, this time to Lebanon, specifically to help Syrian refugees who are living in poverty in informal settlements within the Bica Valley.
And her work there was focused on what?
Raising funds for psychosocial, educational programs, and vocational training designed specifically for women and children who had been displaced. This depth of commitment involving multiple physical trips and focused fundraising is significant.
Beyond international and refugee work, she also served as a visible advocate for women's rights and LGBTQ+ issues domestically.
She began volunteering with the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, in 2016 as an artist ambassador.
A role reserved for individuals who actively support civil rights advocacy.
Right. By 2018, she became a full ambassador, primarily aiding the organization's advocacy for justice in gender issues, which is a cornerstone of the ACLU's mission.
Part of this advocacy included a very public service announcement regarding domestic violence.
Yes. In November 2016, she appeared in a PSA for the hashtag GirlGaze Project. The central message was the importance of making it easier for survivors of violence against women, or VAW, to feel safe coming forward.
She also stressed that society needs to take collective responsibility for how VAW is handled and discussed.
And that December, She also published a powerful letter in Porter magazine addressed to every woman who is suffering in silence, ensuring them they were not alone.
She also utilized her platform to address LGBTQ+ representation within her own industry.
Having publicly come out in 2010, she was able to speak with authority at The Economist's Pride and Prejudice event in March 2017.
And she used that stage to highlight the persistent underrepresentation of LGBTQ characters in mainstream Hollywood film.
She did. She specifically praised actresses who were candid about their own sexuality and actively encouraged influential men in the industry to help challenge the status quo by supporting diverse storytelling.
And she connected that to broader issues of gender parity in Hollywood.
Later that year, she produced a short video for The Economist that specifically addressed the gender pay gap and the general underrepresentation of women in the entertainment industry, making the point that visibility and financial equity go hand in hand.
Finally, we need to cover one of her most focused legislative efforts, advocacy against revenge porn, an effort rooted in her own traumatic experience.
This specific advocacy stems from being a victim of the massive 2014 celebrity nude photo leak, where more than 50 of her personal photos were stolen and released to the public.
A severe breach of privacy.
A horrific one. And she has consistently argued against it. She took those personal experiences to Capitol Hill to push for legislative change.
She became a key advocate for the SHIELD Act.
In May 2019, she gave a speech on Capitol Hill supporting the legislation, which aimed to create federal protections regarding the non-consensual disclosure of private images.
She followed this up with a highly visible op-ed in the New York Times.
In 2019, she used that op-ed to argue that revenge porn is actually an inappropriate label.
Why?
She pointed out that the label implies a motive revenge when the central criminal issue is the fundamental lack of consent and the privacy violation itself. She emphasized the critical need for comprehensive congressional legislation to protect digital privacy, arguing that state laws were proving ineffective and patchy in this area.
Okay, so now we have to address the complex personal life and the highly publicized relationships that led directly to years of intensive litigation.
We could start with her public coming out and her early commitment to transparency regarding her sexuality.
She has always been quite clear that she rejects traditional labels.
That's right. She publicly came out in 2010, but explicitly stated that she doesn't label herself. She's had successful relationships with both men and women.
Her core philosophy, which she has reiterated often, is that I love who I love. It's the person that matters.
And her first major public relationship detailed in the sources was with photographer Tussia Van Rie.
They were together from 2008 to 2012. It was a serious relationship.
Very. Heard legally changed her last name to Van Rie, only reverting to Heard in 2014. And this relationship later became a subject of controversy when details of the 2009 incident were made public.
During the later divorce proceedings, that incident involved an arrest at the airport in Seattle, Washington.
Yes. In 2009, Heard was arrested for misdemeanor domestic violence at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport after allegedly hitting Van Rie. She appeared in court the next day, but notably, no charges were ever filed by the prosecutor.
And the details of this arrest were generally unknown until they surfaced publicly in 2016.
Right. And when that information became public during the height of her divorce from Depp, Van Rie released a statement to address the context of the arrest.
What did she say?
She did. In 2016, Van Rie issued a statement claiming Heard was wrongfully accused and that the incident had been misinterpreted and oversensationalized.
And crucially, Van Rie suggested a layer of prejudice.
She recalled hints of misogynistic attitudes toward us, which later appeared to be homophobic when they found out we were domestic partners and not just friends.
But the sources also contain a direct counterpoint to that claim of prejudice from an eyewitness. This is a critical nuance to report.
It is. The arresting officer, who was later identified and who is herself a lesbian, subsequently posted on social media that the claim of homophobia and wrongful accusation was simply untrue.
What was her account?
She stated clearly and publicly that the arrest was made because an assault occurred, I witnessed it, which directly contradicts Van Rie's narrative that the incident was merely misinterpreted.
Following her divorce from Depp, the sources track a few other high-profile relationships.
She dated tech entrepreneur and Tesla CEO Elon Musk for about a year, until early 2018. Later, she had a relationship with actress and cinematographer Bianca Budi from January 2020 to December 2021.
And regarding her family life, she has since become a mother.
She welcomed her first child, a daughter, via surrogacy in April 2021. The source material further notes that she announced the arrival of twins, a daughter and son, in May 2025.
Let's pivot now to the most visible relationship, the one that led to the global legal scrutiny, Johnny Depp.
They met in 2009 on the set of The Rum Diary, started dating in 2012, and married civilly in February 2015.
But before the divorce proceedings began, there was that strange, highly publicized incident in Australia in April 2015.
The famous Australian dog incident.
It provided early evidence of their relationship being intensely scrutinized by legal and governmental bodies.
It really did. Heard and Depp flew into Queensland, Australia, where Depp was filming, but failed to declare their two dogs, Boo and Pistol, the serious breach of Australia's strict biosecurity laws.
They had to fly the dogs out hours before a mandated euthanasia deadline.
And Heard was later charged by Australian authorities for the breach.
What was the outcome of that case?
Heard ultimately pleaded guilty in April 2016 to the lesser charge of falsifying quarantine documents, explaining she made a mistake due to sleep deprivation.
The more serious criminal charges were dropped?
Correct. She's given a one-month good behavior bond for $1,000 Australian. And famously, she and Depp released that bizarre video apology urging others to adhere to biosecurity laws.
The incident just highlighted the intensely public nature of their lives even before the abuse allegations surfaced.
And the divorce came shortly after, in May 2016. Heard filed for divorce and immediately sought a temporary restraining order.
She alleged verbal and physical abuse in her statement,
detailing angry, hostile, humiliating, and threatening assaults that occurred when she challenged his authority. She also filed for $50,000 monthly spousal support, which was denied by the court.
And Depp's counsel immediately responded, alleging that the claims were financially motivated.
Their initial response was that Heard was attempting to secure a premature financial resolution by alleging abuse. However, Depp's counsel did agree to the request for the restraining order, stating that Depp nonetheless has every intention of staying away from Amber.
The $7 million settlement was reached in August 2016. This is a crucial pivot point given all the later scrutiny.
It is. She dropped the request for a continued restraining order, and the settlement was finalized at $7 million, and they released a joint statement.
And this joint statement is a key source document.
It stated that their relationship was intensely passionate and at times volatile, but always bound by love. Neither party has made false accusations for financial gain. There was never any intent of physical or emotional harm.
That joint statement is fascinating because it seems to explicitly rule out the very things that became the subject of two separate international lawsuits.
Well, it functions more as a legal mechanism to conclude the divorce than a statement of lasting truth, especially given the rapid escalation of claims later on. The final terms were agreed upon in January 2017, with Depp paying the $7 million by February 2018.
And a highly relevant financial detail from the sources is that she could have pursued a much larger sum.
Yes. She testified during the 2022 U.S. trial that because they lacked a prenuptial agreement, she would have legally been entitled to half of Depp's earnings during the marriage.
Which was an estimated $65 million.
Right. So settling for $7 million was significantly less than her potential legal entitlement at the time.
Now, we must unpack the charity pledge controversy, which became a centerpiece of the defamation trials and a major point of public debate.
This is a complex timeline that requires careful explanation. Heard publicly pledged the entire $7 million settlement, splitting it equally between the ACLU and Children's Hospital Los Angeles, CHLA.
Initially, she stated publicly that the donation was complete.
Correct. In an interview on Dutch TV in October 2018, she stated that $7 million in total was donated. And in 2020, during her testimony in the UK trial, she stated under oath that the entire amount of my divorce settlement was donated to charity.
But this was contradicted by her former husband's lawyers and later by the charities themselves, leading to a complex picture of partial fulfillment.
Yes. By January 2021, Depp's lawyers claimed the donations were not complete. Heard's lawyer countered by explaining the donations were delayed because Heard had been forced to spend millions of dollars on legal fees stemming from Depp's initial lawsuit in the U.S.
Which made the money she expected for future donations unavailable.
That was the argument. And let's break down the actual amounts testified to during the 2022 trial.
The testimony was key.
The corporate designee of CHLA testified that as of 2021, Heard had given that organization $250,000.
And the ACLU.
The ACLU's chief operating officer testified that they expected the full amount over a 10-year period, so planned installments, and that $1.3 million had been donated in her name up to that point.
So roughly $1.55 million had been paid, with the rest expected over a long period. A period which was then interrupted by the spiraling legal costs.
That's the critical takeaway. Heard testified in 2022 that defending the case had cost her over $6 million in legal fees, and that she planned to resume the donations when she was financially able to afford it.
So the sources confirm that the initial pledge model was based on long-term installment payments, not a single lump sum.
Exactly. And that her ability to meet those future installments was undermined by the sudden massive legal expenses she incurred defending herself in the U.S. trial.
Now we arrive at the two separate high-profile defamation trials, starting with the UK libel case, Depp v. News Group Newspapers, LTD. This is where the legal divergence begins, and it's essential we explain the legal context.
The UK case, which began in June 2018, was initiated by Depp against NGN, the publisher of The Sun, for labeling him a wife beater in an April 2018 article. Heard served as the key witness for the defense.
The crucial point here is the burden of proof in the UK system for a libel defense.
Exactly. To successfully defend the libel suit, NGN only had to prove that the statement was substantially true.
And in the UK, this is assessed using the civil standard or the balance of probabilities.
Meaning they had to show it was more likely than not that the alleged assault occurred, a much lower bar than in the US.
The verdict was delivered in November 2020, and the judge found in favor of NGN, meaning Depp lost his claim.
The judge concluded that NGN had met the burden of proof. He found that the great majority of alleged assault of Ms. Heard by Mr. Depp, specifically 12 out of the 14, have been proved to the civil standard.
Furthermore, the court explicitly rejected Depp's claim that Heard's allegations were a hoax.
And accepted that her career in activism had suffered due to the ongoing public scrutiny caused by the allegations. Depp's appeal was subsequently rejected in March 2021.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this outcome allowed The Sun to maintain the label of wife beater as substantially true, based on the evidence presented in the UK civil court. It provided a very clear legal finding of fact in that jurisdiction.
That ruling stands in stark contrast to the outcome in the U.S. The difference is fundamentally rooted in the First Amendment and the standard of proof required in U.S. defamation law, particularly for public figures.
Let's move across the Atlantic to the U.S. defamation trial Depp v. Heard, which took place in Virginia. Depp filed this lawsuit in February 2019, seeking $50 million over Heard's December 2018 op-ed in The Washington Post.
The op-ed was titled, "Amber Heard, I Spoke Up Against Sexual Violence and Faced Our Culture's Wrath. That Has to Change." While the piece never explicitly named Depp, he alleged that three specific statements within it were defamatory.
What were those three key statements?
The three statements cited were the headline itself, the line about her becoming a public figure representing domestic abuse, and her assertion that she had the rare vantage point of seeing in real time how institutions protect men accused of abuse.
Because Depp is a public figure, he had to prove not just that the statements were false, but that Heard made them with actual malice.
And what does actual malice mean in this legal context? This is critical for understanding the U.S. verdict.
It's a much higher legal standard to meet than the UK civil standard.
Much higher. Unlike the UK's more likely than not standard, actual malice means the person making the statement either knew the statement was false when they said it, or they acted with reckless disregard for whether the statement was true or false.
And Heard countered this with her own lawsuit based on statements made by Depp's lawyer.
That's right. Heard filed a counterclaim, but the version that went to trial focused specifically on three statements made by Depp's then-lawyer, Adam Waldman, which were published in the Daily Mail.
Let's detail Waldman's three statements, as they were the focus of the jury's findings against Depp.
First, Waldman stated that Heard and her friends used fake sexual violence allegations as both sword and shield, publicizing a sexual violence hoax.
Second,
he addressed a specific incident at a penthouse, describing it as an ambush, a hoax, and claiming Heard and her friends spilled a little wine and roughed the place up before calling 911.
And the third statement?
Third, he referred generally to an abuse hoax by Heard.
The trial took place between April and June 2022, and the jury's verdict was famously complex, with partial wins for both sides.
Let's look at Depp's suit first. The jury found that all three statements from Heard's op-ed were false, defamed Depp, and were made with actual malice.
And they awarded Depp $10 million in compensatory damages and $5 million in punitive,
which Virginia state law quickly reduced. The punitive damages cap is $350,000, bringing Depp's total award to $10.35 million.
Now, for Heard's counterclaim against Depp, focusing on Waldman's statements, the jury did not find Waldman's general claims of a hoax defamatory.
Right, but they singled out the very specific statement about the penthouse incident.
This is the crucial nuance that often gets lost. The jury found that Waldman's first and third statements, the general fake sexual violence allegations and abuse hoax claims, were not proven to be defamatory.
But why did the jury distinguish the second statement, the one about the penthouse, as defamatory?
Because the second statement was highly specific and easily verifiable, Waldman claimed the incident was an ambush, a hoax, and detailed that Heard and her friends spilled a little wine and roughed the place up before calling 911.
So the jury found that this specific factual claim about the penthouse event, that she and her friends vandalized it to stage an attack, was false, defamatory, and made with actual malice by Waldman, acting as Depp's agent.
And Heard won $2 million in compensatory damages based on that single statement.
Correct. She was awarded $2 million in compensatory damages and zero in punitive damages from Depp.
So the verdict essentially affirmed that while the jury found Heard acted with malice in her op-ed, Depp's legal team had also defamed her by making a false, malicious statement about a specific staged incident.
A very complex result. Following the verdict, the online public reaction was overwhelmingly negative toward Heard, which she addressed directly.
She described online criticism of her testimony as agonizing,
saying she was harassed, humiliated, threatened every single day. She questioned how the jury could have believed her when they had already listened to 3.5 weeks of testimony about how I was a non-credible person due to the overwhelming negative media and social media narrative.
And the immediate financial fallout was severe, leading to further litigation.
Her lawyer stated that she could not afford the over $10 million owed to Depp and would appeal the verdict. Then a month later, the complexity deepened when one of Heard's insurance providers, New York Marine, sued her in federal court.
Why would the insurer sue her?
They were seeking to avoid paying up to $1 million for her legal defense fees. Their argument was based on the jury's findings that she had acted with actual malice.
Ah, so they argued that the findings established Heard's liability was caused by her willful acts.
Exactly, which, according to their policy terms, would negate their liability to cover her legal costs. It's just an incredible detail showing the persistent legal and financial pressure she faced.
Ultimately, the case was settled in December 2022 while appeals were pending.
Heard publicly stated that she simply cannot go through a retrial, though she maintained that the settlement was not an act of concession.
And Depp's lawyers, in turn, stated that the original jury verdict remained fully in place.
The settlement resulted in a payment of $1 million being made to Depp by Heard's insurer, a sum which Depp then pledged to donate to charities.
This has been a deep dive into an extraordinary public career marked by massive success, immense legal conflict, and relentless humanitarian commitment. Let's try to summarize the contrasts we've covered.
We charted her path from a young actress who quickly gained critical attention in indie and genre films like Mandy Lane and Pineapple Express to achieving true global stardom in the DCEU.
And concurrently, she became a powerful, visible advocate for human rights via the UN for refugees with SAMs across Jordan and Lebanon.
For domestic violence survivors through the ACLU and for digital privacy via the SHIELD Act.
But the public narrative is rendered profoundly complex by the legal outcomes. On one hand, the UK court found that the majority of her abuse allegations against Depp were proven to the civil standard.
And on the other hand, the US court found that she had defamed Depp with actual malice, resulting in a judgment against her, which she ultimately settled.
This complex result just highlights the enormous difference between the UK civil standard, a lower bar of proof, and the U.S. standard of actual malice, which protects speech unless the speaker knew it was false.
It also reinforces the theme of constant public scrutiny, especially regarding the status of her $7 million charity pledge, which we now know was interrupted by more than $6 million in unexpected legal fees.
And the impact on her career was undeniable, with the confirmed reduction of her role in Aquaman 2 confirmed by both co-stars and critics.
And yet, despite testifying to facing severe legal and financial strain, the sources confirm her continued commitment to activism, suggesting that work remains central to her identity.
This raises an important question. Given the fundamental landscape change moving from massive Hollywood films to independent executive producer roles and now professional theater in Spain, does this indicate a strategic pivot to an environment less defined by the pressures of the Hollywood studio machine?
Or is this move a direct consequence of the legal vortex that fundamentally changed the nature of her celebrity?
What potential does a move into the theater and independent producing offer her moving forward?
Well, these environments often value artistic credibility and sustained performance over pure box office draw or tabloid celebrity. It suggests a possible path forward that prioritizes her craft over the requirements of the franchise machine. And that's something for you to mull or explore on your own.
A fascinating and nuanced question to close on, looking at the possibilities that open up after such monumental closure. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the sources on Amber Heard's career, activism, and legal landscape. We'll see you next time.